This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
This is the BBC.
Welcome to the briefing room with me, David Aronovich. We're in a room and we get briefed. So if you really want to know what's going on in the world, then do listen to this podcast. And please let us know what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. If you're minded to do so, please recommend us to your friends. Recommend us to anyone, really. This week, antimicrobial resistance, the problem of our antibiotics gradually not working anymore. How scary is it and what can we do? The antibiotic resistance apocalypse is on its way if we don't stop it, according to Dame Sally Davies, the Chief Medical Officer for England and Wales. The drugs we have are slowly beginning not to work. Like many listeners, I'm only here because of them. 6 years ago, I very nearly died from septicemia. What saved me, one of the things that saved me, was antibiotics. But even now, hundreds of thousands die across the world because bacteria and other microbes have become resistant to all available drugs. To say healthcare professionals are concerned is an understatement. In this week's briefing room, we're going to find out what the problem actually is, where it's taking us, and what can be done about it. Step inside and find out. This week, Public Health England launched a TV advertising campaign called Keep Antibiotics Working, urging patients to stop asking their doctors for antibiotics.
Antibiotics, we're wonderful pills, but don't ever think we'll cure all of your ills. So every time you feel a bit under the weather, don't always think that we can make you better. Take us for the wrong thing, that's dangerous to do. When you really need us, we could stop working for you.
So please don't end up paying the price. Always take your doctor's advice.
This ad was a response to one of the recommendations of a commission led by economist Jim O'Neill, which reported last year on the scale of the resistance problem. The O'Neill Review was set up by then Prime Minister David Cameron when health professionals persuaded him of the urgency of the problem. We invited Claire Wilson, medical reporter from the New Scientist magazine, into the briefing room to remind us about the world of antibiotics and the impact they've had on our lives.
Some people would say antibiotics are one of the greatest medical discoveries ever made. The famous story is that Alexander Fleming discovered the first one, penicillin, in 1928. In fact, there were a few chemicals discovered to have a similar kind of antibiotic activity being played around with even before then, in the very early 20th century. The very first chemical discovered to have antibiotic activity was discovered against syphilis, which was very useful at the time, as that was a terrible illness that you couldn't treat. Penicillin was the first really effective one, and the famous story is that Alexander Fleming discovered it by accident, almost. He came back from holiday looking at some dishes of bacteria he had left while he'd been away. And when he came back from holiday, he found that one of the dishes, the bacteria that were growing on it, in one little patch, they'd started to die off. And in the middle of that patch, there was a fungus growing, a mould. And this mould was the mould that makes penicillin. It really took off during the Second World War, when people were getting terrible battlefield injuries, and they discovered that they could treat people with terrible burns. And because when people get burned, they often die afterwards from infections of their wounds, and penicillin was marvellous for treating those wound infections. There are a variety of ways that antibiotics can work. They can work by killing bacteria outright, or they can work just by stopping them from growing. They can stop bacteria by destroying the cell wall. Bacterial cells are surrounded with a cell wall that our own cells don't have. So if you have a chemical that can destroy that cell wall, then obviously that's going to harm the bacteria and not harm our own cells. The impact of antibiotics on our world is almost incalculable. As well as being able to treat all the obvious infections like TB, pneumonia, sepsis, there are also things that we perhaps don't think about so much. But today, hardly any woman dies when giving birth. But in the old days, many women used to die from infections during childbirth. Today, we routinely treat people with chemotherapy for cancer and radiotherapy that weakens their immune system. So antibiotics are vital there for treating any infections. People who've received organ transplants, they also have weakened immune systems and depend on antibiotics. So antibiotics aren't just used in medicine, they're also used in farming. And one of the scary things is some of the antibiotics that are used in farming are the same as the ones that you might get from your doctor. Farmers used to just put very, very low doses of the antibiotics into the animals' feed, and they found that the animals grew faster that way, probably because the antibiotics were perhaps killing harmful bacteria within the animals and just helping them get put on muscle more, put on fat more. So we used to routinely do that even in this country. Use of antibiotics as growth promoters in that way has now been banned in Europe, and it has recently also been banned in America too. But in many other countries, it still goes on. The problem is that if you get antibiotic resistance within farm animals, that can spread on to people too in various ways. One way that's recently been discovered, it can even be flies can pass on these bacteria that have antibiotic resistance. There have been cases found of this in China. So if you can imagine, a farm in China is using a lot of antibiotics and the flies land on the cow poo and they pick up bacteria that have antibiotic resistance, the flies then might land in your own home. So obviously that's not good. We think of antibiotic resistance as a very modern problem, but in fact it's been seen since the very earliest days of antibiotic use. Alexander Fleming spoke about the problem of resistance in his acceptance speech when he won his Nobel Prize in 1945. And it was inevitable that when we started using antibiotics in medicine, the mutations that give antibiotic resistance would become more common, and that's exactly what we've seen. A world without antibiotics is a scary thought indeed. And if we just go back 100 years, we were living in such a world then. And people really could die just from a cough or a cold that turned into pneumonia. They could die from everyday infections. There's a famous story about a man who was the first person to be treated with penicillin. He was called Albert Alexander, and he was a policeman. And he went into hospital because he'd just had a scratch on his face from gardening, and it had turned into a terrible infection of the skin of his face, and he was in a very bad way. His entire face was covered in abscesses, his eye had been infected and it had to be removed, it had started to affect his lung, and they started treating him with the very first medical dose of penicillin. And unfortunately, they only had enough to give it to him for a few days, and he started to get better, and then it ran out, and in the end, his infection got worse and he did die from it. All he had was a scratch on his face from a rose, so that thought fills me with terror.
Claire Wilson. Laura Piddock is Professor of Microbiology at Birmingham University, and one of the UK's leading experts in this area. She's advised organisations such as the World Health Organization and governments around the world. She joins me now from Birmingham to help us understand the scale of the problem. Laura Piddock, let's start with the science for beginners. How does biological resistance work?
In essence, the bacterium is able to change itself so that either the antibiotic doesn't get in anymore, or it's sucked out very, very quickly, or the target it binds to just changes so that much more drug is required. And finally, sometimes bacteria are able to produce enzymes that will chew up or inactivate the drug.
So originally you have a bacterium which is susceptible to the antibiotic. How does it change into being one that is not susceptible to the antibiotic?
So, in essence, two things. The bacterium can either acquire DNA from other bacteria, so it can get the DNA that will then incorporate into its own DNA, and it can then make new things that it couldn't make before, such as these enzymes that inactivate drugs. Or alternatively, bacteria are evolving all the time, and just sometimes a mutation will occur in its DNA that makes it less susceptible or even resistant to drugs. And when we apply an antibiotic, we give it the pressure to make the drug susceptible strains die so that only the resistant ones survive, and they proliferate. So every time we use an antibiotic, anywhere, any place, we're making an environment for those drug-resistant mutants to grow up and proliferate. And then we make it much worse because we spread them around between us, between countries, between hospitals, everywhere. We share them.
One of the things you seem to have described there is a process of Darwinian natural selection, an evolutionary process. But what you've described there seems very quick. I always thought evolution was supposed to be slow.
Well, it depends on the organism. Bacteria such as E. coli double the number of cells within a population about every 20 minutes, which means a very, very rare mutation gets selected for and becomes the dominant population within 24 hours.
People often talk about resistance as if it's they themselves that are resistant rather than the bacteria.
Well, of course, that's not true. It's the bacterium that becomes resistant. It's never the patient that becomes antibiotic resistant.
OK, now, we heard earlier that Alexander Fleming predicted the growth of resistance way back in the 1940s. It's scientifically predictable from what you've said. We know it's used in agriculture, antibiotics are used in agriculture a lot, but also antibiotics are used in a lot of consumer products, which I hadn't realised. Can you tell me a bit about that?
The word antibiotic is often widely used but often misused. So as a scientist, an antibiotic is a substance that will either inhibit the growth or kill bacteria in a test tube. That doesn't necessarily mean they're a drug you can use in people. So there are lots of antibiotic molecules that are in shampoo, in washing up liquid, the liners of fridges, but they're also drugs we use in people. They're also substances that they use in aquaculture to spray on fruit trees and also to treat infections in animals. So they're absolutely everywhere.
How big a problem is the loss of antibiotic effectiveness in the main antibiotics we use?
For most people, the drugs we've got are still effective. The problems we're seeing are in vulnerable people, particularly those who go into hospital. And what we're now seeing is that the first, second or third choice drug of, say, 10 years ago is not likely to work. So we're having to use what we call our critically important drugs much more often. And because resistance to these drugs is now sweeping across the world, we are faced that for certain infections in certain patients, that sometimes there's only one option. And so, for instance, some bone marrow transplant units in Italy have had to close because they cannot guarantee that their patients won't get a certain type of infection, which is untreatable for them.
So let's get this absolutely straight. There are treatments which have been given, which we've been used to being given. You've given the example of the bone marrow treatment in Italy, which are either not being given or which fairly soon won't be able to be given because of resistance to antibiotics and antimicrobials.
For some patients, yes.
The O'Neill report, which looked into tackling drug-resistance infections last year, estimated that by 2050, 10 million lives were at risk, and the potential economic and security costs could be as high as $100 trillion. So what are we going to do about it? I'm also joined in the briefing room now by Jeremy Knox, Head of Policy on Drug-Resistant Infections at the Wellcome Trust, a global health charity. Jeremy, can you briefly outline the challenge here?
So I think there's a threefold approach we need to take to tackling drug resistance. I think firstly, there's the issue of overuse of antibiotics and reducing the overuse and excessive use of antibiotics so that the ones that we have last a bit longer. So that means reducing unnecessary prescription of them and also addressing how they're used in agriculture. The second thing is we need more new antibiotics. The WHO released a report last month.
WHO.
World Health Organization released a report last month that showed that there's only about 50 products in the pipeline. And that may sound like a lot, but actually most of them will never reach the market. Many of them will not address the greatest needs that we have, the most urgent needs that we have. And really, when you compare it to other areas of therapeutic development, the pipeline is incredibly thin. So we need to support drug development. We need to overcome some of the long-term decline in investment in antibiotic R&D and make sure that we have a healthy
R&D
supply.
R&D being research and development.
Yes, sorry. And make sure that we have a healthy supply of new drugs so that we can ensure we have a healthy arsenal of antibiotics for the future.
So one, get more use out of the antibiotics we've got. Two, get new ones. And three,
I think the third part is making sure we have a globally coordinated effort. This really is a truly global problem and one that doesn't respect borders. So we need to have international cooperation. We've seen global leaders increasingly taking the issue seriously. It's gone onto the agenda of the G20, and we had a significant landmark UN agreement on this last year. But now we need to deliver on the promise of that and really make sure that we're giving countries and governments the tools that they need to respond to this challenge in a globally coordinated way.
OK, so let's look at one first, which is the question of how we get more out of the antibiotics we've got. So in general terms, how do we do that?
One of the main challenges we have is that we know that far too many antibiotics are prescribed in situations where actually they may not be needed. So we need to give doctors the tools that they need to make better informed decisions and to have better discussions with patients about when they may really need an antibiotic. So on the one hand, that's an element of patient awareness, but also on a technological front, it's about giving doctors the diagnostic tools that they need to make better informed decisions. At the moment, if you go and see your GP, then more often than not, they're having to make a judgment based on nothing more than a conversation, a short conversation, and an assessment of what might be quite nondescript symptoms. And there's no real way for them to test or tell whether it's a bacterial infection or a viral infection, which, of course, wouldn't respond to antibiotics.
Laura, in your experience, how difficult is it to persuade both GPs and patients that they might not need the antibiotics that they think they've relied upon?
So in terms of healthcare professionals, including GPs, I think most do not want to overprescribe these drugs. Patients get frightened. There is the fear factor with an infection that you might be that very rare person who becomes very ill and your life is threatened very quickly. And that fear also goes through to doctors as well. So what we need to do is actually educate everybody from our children upwards about how precious this resource is, how these drugs work, very simply, that they only work against bacteria, and how do we use them best? But so, secondly, we need research on how much drug we have to give our patients that will minimise the selection of resistant bacteria. So two things to keep our drugs lasting as long as possible.
So let's cut to the chase here. Patient comes in, says, I feel really, really, really lousy. How about an antibiotic? It worked last time. doctor's got 10 minutes with them, etc. Does the doctor send them out of the door saying, I'm not convinced that you need this, just, you know, suck it up, go to bed, get better?
Sometimes some doctors do indeed send their patients home without a prescription, but there is a toolkit available for doctors called Target, and this gives them a variety of ways of discussing this with patients, and in particular giving a post-dated prescription, which they will say to the patient, if you don't feel better after a set period of time, go and get some antibiotics. And that's proving very useful, so the patient feels that they've got an effective treatment should they need it.
One of the things that I've read is that in places like India, you can order antibiotics by mail order. I mean, never mind whether or not a GP gets to have a conversation with you, you can just get the stuff yourself.
That's true of many countries outside the EU, and that's because it's access to medicine. And many people can't access a healthcare professional, but they can go and purchase drugs from a street market or even a pharmacy. In fact, some southern European countries, you could still do that. So if you restricted the use of drugs globally to only those from a healthcare professional, then there would be millions of people who can't get these drugs.
Jeremy, let's talk now about agriculture, because I was going to say industrial scale, but I suppose it is an industrial scale use of antibiotics on animals worldwide.
Yeah, very true. They're a very important part of agriculture. I think it's important to draw a distinction between different uses here. So on the one hand, of course, there is a very legitimate need for vets to be able to treat sick animals, and that's very important both in terms of a welfare issue and in terms of a productivity issue. I think the more controversial area is the fact that in many parts of the world, you still see antibiotics given for growth promotion. So really on the basis that it's known or it's believed that you can increase yields and you can increase the rate that an animal puts on weight by giving them a very low dose of antibiotic as part
of their
feed.
Where is that happening now?
For instance, in Asia, we know it takes place. In the US, until very recently, it was still quite widespread practice.
And Laura, as far as you know, who's still doing it most?
Specifics are actually hard to come by. We know they're still used like this in Asia. We know they're still used in the Americas as well. But it is sporadic use, and it will depend on the company that's producing that meat product.
OK. Now, let's move, therefore, from overuse and go to the what seems to a lot of people to be the kind of obvious thing. Why, if our drugs are kind of not good enough, why don't we just make new ones? I mean, after all, if we have a pharmaceutical industry that can develop something as miraculous as Viagra and so on, you'd have thought, wouldn't you, that we could get new antibiotics. Jeremy?
Yeah, so I think that's true, that pharmaceutical companies over the past 20 or 30 years have in large part withdrawn from the area, and there's much less investment than we'd like to see in the space at the moment. And I think that's because it's been characterised as a market failure. So really, there isn't a sufficiently attractive market for antibiotics to encourage private companies to
now,
do the research.
Now, take me through that. Here we have these great things, antibiotics, which a lot of us use a lot of the time and so on. And we're desperate to get some new ones. How can that not be a commercial proposition for the company that can develop them?
With most pharmaceutical products in other areas, if you have a breakthrough new product, then that will come to the market and be a blockbuster. It will be the product that everyone wants to use, and it will take a huge section of the market. Antibiotics is a bit different, though. If we have a new breakthrough antibiotic at some point in the future, then that will be held back for only the patients that really need it. Those are the patients for whom all of the long-standing generic antibiotics that have been around for many years, they'll be the patients for whom those products haven't worked. So actually, if you bring a new product to market, you're only going to be used in a very small handful of patients.
Laura, is that it? I mean, is it because, let's say, with something like Viagra, you know, lots and lots of people can take it and so on, but with antibiotics, you're not going to make so much money because you don't want everybody to take it?
Well, that's true today, but it wasn't necessarily true when companies started withdrawing from this area. I mean, one of the issues is from the late 90s onwards that many of the companies merged and merged again, so there's far few companies actually in this area by the mid-2000s. But secondly, new antibiotics are sold very cheaply compared to other products, particularly if you compare them to anti-cancer drugs. We're talking about the difference of literally tens of pounds versus thousands of pounds for a product. And companies, they're there to make a profit for their shareholders. They make commercial decisions, and this is not a profitable area or as profitable an area as other pharmaceutical products.
But why is it not? I mean, if you need antibiotics like you need the cancer drugs, why can't you price it so that it actually works out for the company?
I think it's a very tricky question. I think there are technical reasons why it's very difficult to value antibiotics at the same level that comes down to the way that you calculate the effectiveness of products. I think more generally, there is a question around, actually, do we want to have high prices on antibiotics? There are real questions around, actually, is it the right model to have a company which makes its profits on an antibiotic on the basis of essentially price by volume? Because we don't want these products to be oversold. We don't want these products to be overused. So actually, having an antibiotic that costs tens of thousands of pounds, I think it's a very tricky position to be in. And more to the point, I think actually in terms of access to these products, where we're looking at problems of access in the low and middle income countries, actually having that sort of ultra high priced product is a really tricky proposition to grapple with.
So the problem for the company is that we need them to develop a cheap drug that isn't used very often, but we desperately need them to do it.
I think that's a very good way to summarise it, and I think that's why we need to look at ways to incentivise drug development that don't rely on very high prices or larger volumes.
That's exactly what needs to be done. And indeed, the model of antibiotic discovery, research and development has changed completely in the last 15 years. So really, the big companies now are investing their money in developing substances that look as if they're going to be druggable, in other words, make new medicines. And the discovering and the research and understanding all the properties of these new drugs, whether they're toxic even, that's pretty much the domain of universities, research institutes and small companies.
Jeremy, one obvious thing that could be done here is that the government could just say, we'll give you a whole lot of money to do it, or governments could do.
So I think there's two ways that governments and other people can incentivise drug development. There's firstly what we'd call push. So that's the incentivising early stage research and essentially subsidising the early stage high risk funding that Laura was just talking about. That's already going on. We're seeing increasing amounts go into that space. But we also need to look at the downstream pull. So correcting the fact that we don't have either a high price or a high volume at the end. So we've seen proposals. So for instance, from Lord O'Neill's report to the UK government on this problem, he proposed something called a market entry reward, which would be a big lump sum, perhaps in the region of $1 billion, that would essentially reward a successful new product when it comes to market. And the idea behind that is that offsets the development costs, offsets the development risk, but doesn't put a big pressure on companies to sell it at high price or high volume.
Taking up this point about international cooperation, I suppose the first point is, how do you get to persuade the countries that overuse antibiotics to stop? And then the second question is, how do you get all governments to commit to the funding and incentivising, that you call it, the research required to develop new drugs?
All countries overuse antibiotics to some extent. So I don't want it to look like there's an us and them dynamic between different parts of the world. We're all guilty of misusing and overusing antibiotics. In terms of the funding question, I think that's a very tricky one. And there's been discussions, for instance, in the G20 around how actually that group of countries can collectively start moving along some of these conversations around how to kickstart antibiotic development. The G20 agreed this year to set up something called an R&D, a research and development hub in Berlin. And that's going to start coordinating efforts to do the research that's needed to tackle these problems.
OK, Laura, it's crystal ball time. Are we going to manage to do these things that we're trying to do in time to cover ourselves from the loss of efficacy of existing antibiotics? Or is there going to be a gap?
I think for most people, we will have effective drugs. There will, without doubt, be patients who will die due to drug-resistant infections. And at the moment, the numbers of those per year globally is increasing. I hope with the one to two drugs that it looks as if we may have in the next 5 years, that we can halt that increase.
Jeremy, do you agree with that?
Yes, I think we know that already drug resistance and failing drugs is already a reality for many people. So TB, for instance, particularly in Southern Africa and Southeast Asia. I think we will see gradual progress in terms of the international cooperation piece, but I think it will be a difficult process. And now as we go from the political rhetoric to actually action and trying to help low and middle income countries and acting on this topic, it's going to be a difficult and slow process.
We've had a lot of political rhetoric in the last couple of years. If we don't start getting serious funding, and although it's already, you know, the World Trust are putting a significant amount of money in, this needs to be matched across the world. We need billions of pounds into this area to really resolve this properly. And we actually need to stop talking about it and acting now. We are at the beginning of starting to resolve this crisis of drug resistance. We're nowhere near the middle or the end.
Well, I don't think I need to add anything to that. The science is clear as is the call to action. My thanks to all my guests, Claire Wilson, Laura Piddock and Jeremy Knox. The Briefing Room is back in a month's time. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by Jim Frank. Please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. We look forward to reading your comments. They're genuinely useful.